You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 287, Exodus 20, part 1. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing this week?
Pretty good. Hey, we're at the halfway point. Oh, what do you know?
Oh, my gosh. Is it 2020? What year is this? right. Is anybody out there getting Exodus?
I see what you did there. 20 and 20 is 40 chapters. Yeah, that's so clever. Yeah.
Man. It's a grind, but, I mean, it's worth it. Don't get me wrong. Nobody's complaining.
Yeah. Well, that's good.
It is. What it is. I hope they're not complaining. If they are, right. I mean, this is your wheelhouse. Such a monumental.
Well, you know, honestly, you know, you're not going to, nobody in our audience is going to sit in church and go through Exodus in this much detail. So, yeah, you know,
we'll have over 40 hours plus of commentary on Exodus alone. That's a gold mine, in my opinion. I wish.
Yeah. I mean, as long as nobody complains, I'm good.
Man, when I first discovered you, I would have given anything to have 40 hours on anything, you know?
So, yeah. Well,
it's good stuff.
I've met enough people out speaking that I know a lot of people feel that way. So yeah, Mike, it's unfortunate.
Mike, I watched the Ten Commandments movie again the other day for this episode. Again, I did. I put it on. I have it recorded, right? DVR'd. I put it on just because, you know, we're here, chapter 20, and four
is that your 2020th time? See what I did there.
Yeah. And what's funny is my daughter was there, my wife's there. So, you know, you put it on and you suck everybody in watching it 4.5 hours later.
It is.
This is so good. Such a good movie. It's not accurate. I know. Don't get me wrong, but it's just such a good movie.
Yeah. It's iconic. You know, it's one of those movies that once you walk by the TV and you sit down and you start watching, it's like, okay, you're going to be there to the end. You know, it's one of those.
Well, Mike, everybody knows that we have swag now, and I just want to give a quick shout-out to Mark, who took a picture of his coffee mug in front of his computer, and then also Trey in Louisiana. He bought a onesie, Mike, and posted the picture in our Facebook group of his baby wearing a onesie of the Naked Bible, the one with our faces
on. That's dedication right there.
Oh, my gosh, it's so funny. It is so funny. It's awesome. So if you do have some merchandise, I would love to see y'all using it or wearing it, use the hashtag Naked Bible, whatever social media platform you use, just post it using Naked Bible. And, it'd be funny to see, y'all out there in the wild using, Naked Bible.
Yeah. See what you can come up with.
Yeah. It's fantastic. I love it. But we appreciate that. Thanks, for everybody who bought something.
Yeah. It's a good way. I mean, somebody's going to ask you about your t-shirt or whatever. And you say, yeah, you know, that's from the Naked Bible Podcast. You ought to listen to it. So it's a good way to promote it.
Well, Mike, I'm so excited about Exodus 20. I'm glad that it's part one too. So we have in 10 parts on this one.
No, I know we're going to have at least two, obviously, but, probably it's going to take a while to get through the commandments. So I would say at least three. You know, we'll see, but I would think at least three. Well, this one, you know, obviously is going to be a preliminary episode, part one. We're going to cover issues related to Exodus 20 and what we call the Ten Commandments. We won't actually get into any of the specific commandments on this one. And you think, well, how in the world, you know, are there really that many questions? It's just the Ten Commandments. I mean, you know, what's so complicated about that? Well, nothing's ever really that simple, you know, in biblical studies. And again, I think you're going to see as we go through this, a lot of these questions are not just stuff that scholars, you know, come up with or invent, but there are things that arise from the text. Just even the phrase, Ten Commandments, we're going to learn that there's some controversy to that. So the one thing we should say up front is you're going to hear me use the word Decalogue as well. That is another way to refer to the Ten Commandments specifically, as they appear in Exodus 20 or in Deuteronomy. Again, so if you hear me using that word, that's what it means. You know, it's just another way of referring to the Ten Commandments. So one of the things we need to sort of discuss out of the gate and I'm not going to spend too much time on this, is the source critical debate. You know, that this is the JEDP stuff again. And the reason I bring it up, I hope will become evident. You know, any scholar who holds to a mainstream view of the authorship of the Torah, the Pentateuch, the JEDP stuff, you know, that the Torah is just a patchwork quilt of sources. Anyone who takes that view would see the laws of Exodus 20 and other places in the Torah, i.e. Deuteronomy, but also other places in Exodus. They're going to see all that as the result of authorship of varied sources from various time periods. JEDP, again, this approach to the Torah, the documentary hypothesis, is married to the history of religions school. That's an academic term again, which presumes an evolutionary development of Israelite religion from the primitive, you know, primitive polytheism to the more enlightened, you know, enlightened monotheism, which we've talked about other times on the show. Now, as an example of how this thinking affects the Decalogue, consider this trajectory. Since later prophets like Amos focus on ethics and social justice. I mean, Amos is famous, you know, for this. See what I did there? I rhymed, okay? But Amos, the book of Amos, any study of that, you're going to get into ethics and social justice because there's so much content in that book about that stuff. So since that's true, scholars would presume, if you take this evolutionary trajectory view of Israelite religion, they would presume that the principles of the Ten Commandments found somewhere in Amos, you know, when Amos applies the Ten Commandments, that would suggest that the principles, the Ten Commandments themselves, come from the time of Amos. That's the 8th century BC, which is long after the period of Moses. The 8th century BC would coincide with, you know, you might think this is circular reasoning, but this is just how people are going to think. The 8th century BC would coincide with the time, therefore, that the E document, because that's where Exodus 20 is supposedly from, that would coincide with when the E document was composed, from which major parts of the book of Exodus derives, again, hypothetically. Now, the essay on the Ten Commandments from the Anchor Bible Dictionary notes this. Just listen to this here. Many of the critical studies of the Decalogue took issue with the tradition of its Mosaic origins on the basis of a history of religion's approach to the content of the Ten Commandments. It was argued, for example, that the social ethic expressed in the Decalogue is under the influence of the 8th century prophets, Amos, Hosea, Isaiah, Micah, and that the first commandment, you know, having no other gods before me, was unthinkable prior to the time of Hosea. The Mosaic origins of the Ten Commandments were therefore questioned on the basis of a developmental theory with regard to Israel's religion and ethics. That's the end of the quote. So again, I'm not creating a caricature here of critical approaches to the Ten Commandments. There it is. That's Anchor Bible Dictionary. This is the way that this is thought about. Now, this isn't a graduate Hebrew course, so we're not going to get bogged down in source critical theory here. I'm more interested in the text as we have it, not hypothesizing about where all the parts came from and when they were created. Because I do think, as I've said many times before, I do think a lot of that is circular reasoning. So what we're going to do is look at issues that are apparent from the text as received. And we're going to start with the placement of the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, in the book of Exodus. So I'm going to read an excerpt here from the Dictionary of the Old Testament, Pentateuch, volume, as follows. In Exodus 20, where God gives the law at Sinai, the Decalogue is situated at the beginning of the Book of the Covenant. Now, let me just stop there. The Book of the Covenant, quote unquote, that's not a reference to the whole book of Exodus. The Book of the Covenant is a reference to all of the portions of Exodus that are concerned with laws, you know, crimes, punishment, ethics. You know, Exodus 20 is going to start that, but then it's, you know, what we read in the Ten Commandments is going to get expanded elsewhere in the book of Exodus. So that's what the book of the covenant means. Okay. So back to the quote. So the Decalogue is at the beginning of the book of the covenant. Source and redaction critics, redaction is a word that means editing. Source and redaction critics have argued that the Decalogue interrupts the flow of material between Exodus 19 and chapter 20, verse 18. Now, I want you to think about that. If you read, let me just stop here. If you read Exodus 19, beginning in Exodus 19, all the way through the end of 20, and then on into 21 and 22 and so on and so forth. It does feel interruptive. The first 17 verses of Exodus 20, if you go back into chapter 19, for instance, you know, you've got the scene at Sinai there about, the Lord said, come up, bringing Aaron with you. Don't let the priests and people break through to come up here. And then all of a sudden we've got the Ten Commandments. Well, what happened in the rest of the scene? You know, it feels interruptive is the point. Now back to the quote. So if you take the Decalogue out, with the Decalogue removed, if you actually just plucked it right out of your Bible, the remaining material after, the Decalogue describes a theophany in which God instructs Moses to set limits around the holy mountain, with only Moses and Aaron allowed to ascend the mountain. The people, frightened by the thunderous theophany, request that Moses be their intermediary so that they will not die from standing in God's overwhelming presence. Now, let me just stop there. Here's Exodus 20, verse 18, right after the commandments end. Now, when all the people saw the thunder and flashes of lightning and the sound of the trumpet, the mountain smoke, the people were afraid and trembled and said to Moses, "You speak to us, we will listen. Don't let God speak to us, lest we die." Blah. So, it just seems like the commandments should sort of come after all the mountain scene setting. Because when you get to Exodus 20, verse 22, we get more laws. There are laws about altars, for instance. Like why do we have, source critics would say, why in the world are the first 17 verses, the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, why is it plopped down sort of right in the middle of this mountain scene? And then the mountain scene resumes before we get to other laws. Wouldn't it have made more sense to just put all the laws together, beginning with the Ten Commandments? And so when they see that, that raises questions about, well, maybe what we have here is just a material from a couple of sources that somebody just put together and probably could have been put together more smoothly, but it's evidence, again, of this patchwork kind of thing going on. So again, we're talking about the placement now. We're not going to get into source critical theory and all that stuff. But this is worth thinking about, and I would suggest, and other people have had this suggestion who are not concerned about source critics and source criticism. You know, what are the original sources of all this? Okay, people who approach the Bible in literary terms propose something different. They would say, okay, the placement of the Decalogue in Exodus 20 is, indeed interruptive. But that doesn't prove any part of chapters 19 or 20 come from different sources and time periods. There may be, and again, various scholars have proposed there is, a literary or structural reason for the ordering of the material as we have it. There may be some other reason rather than sources. There may be some literary design going on here, something intentional. Now, Durham, in his Word Biblical Commentary, comments on this, and I want to highlight a couple of observations he makes. So here's the quote from Durham. He says, "In some ways, the single most important point about the canonical form of the Decalogue is not what this section contains, but its location. The commandments are given as an integral part of the Sinai narrative sequence and as an essential segment of the account of Yahweh's presentation of himself to Israel within that sequence. Some literary critics, indeed, have even suggested that the relocation of the Decalogue is an uneasy insertion disruptive of the narrative sequence of which it is now a part. Such suggestions, he says, are mistaken, however, not alone for the violence they do to an Exodus, and again, that's the book of Exodus, carefully planned and arranged, for very definite reasons, into the form in which we have received it. The Ten Commandments must first of all be seen as Exodus, the book of Exodus, presents them. Words addressed by Yahweh himself to Israel, gathered by his command at the perimeter of holiness about the base of Mount Sinai. They form an essential part of Israel's experience of Yahweh's advent, and to detach them from the narrative preceding and following them compromises our understanding of both that narrative and the commandments themselves. With such a point clearly in mind, better consideration can be given to the form of the Decalogue, especially the question whether that form may have been dictated in part by the original purpose of the commandments and in part by continuing application of the principles set forth by them to life lived out in Israel in covenant with Yahweh. At least five aspects of the form the Decalogue has taken, and by form he means the, the order of the commands themselves, and also, again, where they're situated in the book. He says about five aspects of the form of the Decalogue has taken need to be considered. Now, this is me speaking. Now, I'm going to only mention two here for the purpose of this episode. Here's one. Durham says we need to consider the ancient Near Eastern covenantal legal form to which the commandments are obviously related. In other words, well, maybe the Book of Exodus is trying to intentionally to mimic the way ancient Near Eastern covenants were ordered in their content. And then secondly, we need to consider the connection between the commandments and other Old Testament covenant legal collections, in particular the Book of the Covenant at large, which is Exodus 20, verse 22, all the way really toward the end of chapter 23. So that's the end of the Durham quote, you know, and what he's saying is, look, there are going to be discernible reasons why the stuff is where it is. If we just, you know, we don't flip out and say, oh, the editor, you know, had no idea what he was doing. It's just haphazard. What a goofball. Or if we just say, well, this is obviously from, you know, independent sources, blah, 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 blah. And Durham's saying, nah, you don't really need to draw those conclusions. Those are conclusions that overreach the data. Now, we'll be hitting on both of those ideas. That Durham listed, the ancient Near Eastern covenantal form, and then the bigger picture as we proceed. But for now, just note that the interruptive feel and sequence of the Decalogue may be due to Exodus 19 and 20, really even beyond that. That material following ancient Near Eastern covenantal forms and elements. Second topic we want to say something about, are the Ten Commandments the actual or original Ten Commandments? You say, what kind of a crazy question is that? It sounds odd, but the question arises for two reasons. First, the Hebrew phrase from which Ten Commandments as a term derives does not occur in Exodus 20. It actually occurs later in Exodus 34, verse 28. Let me read you verses 27 and 28. And the Lord said to Moses, write these words, for in accordance with these words, I have made a covenant with you and with Israel. So he was there with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights. He neither ate bread nor drank water, and he wrote on the tablets the words of the covenant, the 10 words, or in the ESV, the 10 commandments. That's Exodus 34, 27, and 28. So it's not until Exodus 34 that we actually get the phrase, the Hebrew phrase, in Aseret HaDevarim, the 10 words. And so, you know, people look at that, well, why wouldn't that occur when the list is actually given? That's kind of odd. The phrase, again, the Hebrew phrase, also occurs in Deuteronomy 4:13 and Deuteronomy 10:4. But again, does not appear at all in Exodus 20. Now, Nahum Sarna, we've been, you know, quoting his Exodus commentary, you know, periodically through the series. He writes this. He says, the present chapter, Exodus 20, carries no designation for this document, you know, the Decalogue. The popular English title, The Ten Commandments, is derived from the traditional, although inaccurate, English rendering of the Hebrew phrase Aseret HaDevarim that appears in Exodus 34:28 and in Deuteronomy 4:13 and 10:4. In fact, the term commandment, which is Hebrew mitzvah, the plural is mitzvot, is not employed in the present context. In other words, that word doesn't occur in Exodus 20. The Hebrew means rather the 10 words, which the Jews of ancient Alexandria in Egypt translated literally into Greek as Decalogoi. This gave rise to the more accurate English alternative, Decalogue. So Decalogue actually means 10 words. It doesn't mean 10 commandments, because the Hebrew word for commandment is an entirely different word than we get in Exodus 34 and Deuteronomy 4, Deuteronomy 10. And then Sarna adds, in fact, traditional, this is Jewish exegesis, derived 13, not 10 commandments from what we know as the Decalogue. We're going to get into this. You know, it depends on how you group certain statements in Exodus 20 verses 1 through 17. Again, that's where we get the quote-unquote 10 commandments, all right? It depends on how you group certain statements, whether you come out with 10 or in the case of, you know, ancient Jewish exegesis, 13. And even in the Christian tradition, Protestant and Catholic, this is an issue. You know, how, okay, we have 10 commandments, but how are they worded? You know, so Christian tradition will settle on 10, but depending on what you group with what and what you separate, you know, the wording is going to be different. Now, the Inner Varsity Press, you know, again, that dictionary, the Old Testament Pentateuch, I'm going to refer to what it says here because it's useful. The Decalogue in Exodus appears to be given a second time in chapter 34. So when you get the 10 words in Exodus 34, there's a lot of overlap between that and Exodus 20. Back to the quote. When Moses discovers that the Israelites began worshiping the golden calf in his absence, he angrily breaks the tablets containing the laws. Moses then ascends Sinai yet again, where God gives a set of replacement tablets. Though Exodus 34:28 says that God, quote, wrote on the tablets the words of the covenant, the Ten Commandments, unquote, the commands given in Exodus 34 are clearly different from the ones recorded in Exodus 20. They do not precisely overlap. There's new material in Exodus 34, and Exodus 34 is the one that actually refers to the 10 words. The prohibition against idols and the call to Sabbath rest do appear in Exodus 34, but the remaining stipulations pertain to religious festivals and sacrifices. That material about festivals and sacrifices is included in Exodus 34, and those are the 10 words. Back to the quote again. The Decalogue occurs yet another time in Deuteronomy 5, where its form and content are comparable to the material in Exodus 20. A book of speeches, Deuteronomy, has a sermonic exhortative quality. Here the Decalogue is incorporated into hortatory, that's exhortational material, by Moses, that reminds Israel of its covenantal identity and responsibility in preparation for entering Canaan. Deuteronomy recalls the giving of these laws at Mount Horeb, a more general name for the locale rather than Mount Sinai, the more specific name for the mountain. Apart from that difference of name for the holy mountain, distinct differences between the Exodus version and the Deuteronomy version of the Decalogue are minimal. The commandment to observe a Sabbath rest in Exodus is based on God's divine rest on the seventh day. In Deuteronomy, the motivation for a Sabbath rest is Israel's memory of its enslavement in Egypt. So that's the end of the quotation. It actually gives you an example there of how the laws in Exodus, the commandments in Exodus and Deuteronomy are different. The motivation for the Sabbath rest is different in both accounts. Okay. Now, is there a discernible reason for these differences and the repetitions of the Decalogue in these, you know, in Exodus and Deuteronomy? And, you know, Exodus 34 as well. Well, you know, most would say, yeah, there is. I'm going to limit this to the repetition in Exodus 34. You know, we'll hit later in part two, and maybe we'll even have a part three, as I said at the beginning. We'll hit differences between Exodus and Deuteronomy in the Decalogue when we get to the individual commandments. Now, Durham writes as follows about Exodus 34 and this whole issue. Exodus 34, 10 to 28 has been woven with some care into the larger narrative whole that is now Exodus 32 through 34, with the express purpose of suggesting the renewal of the covenant relationship between Yahweh and Israel. This section has been pieced together from material taken from several areas of interest. For example, covenant renewal, the avoidance of syncretistic influence, Yahweh the jealous God, gifts and sacred festivals due to Yahweh. Now, so it's been taken from material from several areas of interest in order to present an overall impression of covenant renewal that, number one, emphasizes complete loyalty to Yahweh, and this is a deliberate contrast to the terrible sin with the calf. So it emphasizes complete loyalty to Yahweh, whose justified jealousy is stressed as a warning against the temptation of a divided loyalty. And number two, summarizing in a deliberate mingling of themes from the Ten Commandments in what is now called the Book of the Covenant, you know, earlier in Exodus, or more fully in Exodus, let's put it that way. An array of requirements directed against exactly the kind of disobedience the sin with the golden calf presented. So that's the end of the quote. So in other words, Durham is saying, look, you know, some of the differences in Exodus 34 are very obviously due to the incident. of the golden calf, which occurred while Moses, you know, was up getting the commandments. And so when we have to do the commandments the second time around, there are going to be some alterations to reflect this incident and reflect God's attitude toward it. And so he's saying that's why you're going to get these differences between Exodus 20 and Exodus 34. It's what happens in between. You know, fair enough. And again, when we get to the individual commands, we'll talk about why there are differences between Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5 in the actual commands. But we're going to move on, for sake of this episode, to a third consideration, the number of the commands. You know, we just brought this up a few moments ago, so let's drill down a little bit on it. Are there 10 or more than 10? Now, I'm going to share something here that I wrote for Bible Study Magazine. And on the episode page for this website, you're actually going to see this in chart form. Okay, so there'll be a link there to a visualization of what I'm going to say here. But this is from Bible Study Magazine, which again is pitched, you know, for the average, you know, churchgoer. So there's not going to be a whole lot of detail here, but I think it sort of captures the issue here. It seems to go without saying that the list of the Ten Commandments is something that Judaism and Christianity have always agreed upon. Well, that's not exactly true. Historically speaking, Jews and Christians, and even denominations within Christianity, have disagreed on exactly how the Ten Commandments should be listed and expressed. In fact, how to precisely spell out the commandments was an issue of considerable importance during the Protestant Reformation. The difference concerns how many commands are to be found in the first 6 verses and then the last 2 verses of Exodus 20, verses 2 through 17, which is the initial listing of the commandments received by Moses at Sinai. Again, the chart, this is me breaking in here, the chart that, again, we're going to have linked on the episode webpage, illustrates those disagreements. So back to my Bible Study Magazine portion. Interestingly, the Jewish tradition treats the statement in Exodus 20, verse 2, and you could compare Deuteronomy 5, verse 6, as a command when the wording has no imperative force to it at all. Exodus 22, I'll read it. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Well, it's very odd. There's nothing commanded there. But the Jewish tradition treats that statement as a command. Okay, just kind of odd. This latitude, back to the Bible Study Magazine portion, this latitude arises from the fact that the Hebrew text of the Old Testament exclusively uses Aseret HaDevarim, 10 words, instead of Aseret HaMitzvot, 10 commands, with respect to the contents of Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5. After regarding Exodus 20, verse 2, as the first word of the 10 words, again, this is in Jewish tradition, verses 3 through 6 are then thematically understood as speaking to a single prohibition, and that is making idols for worship. That's what's prohibited. There are actually 3 imperative statements in this group of verses, verses 3 through 6. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image. You shall not bow down to them or serve them. But to consider them as separate commands would move the total beyond 10. Now, let me stop there. So in other words, Jewish tradition is going to take that first statement in Exodus 22 as one of the words. And then these 3 imperatives that follow in verses 3 through 6, they're also going to split out. Okay. And what you've got here is you've got more than 10 words. Just like Sarna said, in Jewish tradition, you actually have 13 commandments. So if you take verse 2, okay, that's not a commandment, but it's one of the words. So this is going to sound really odd. It's not a command, but it's one of the 10 words. But now we're going to take the 3 imperatives that follow in verses 3 and 6 and split them out into separate commands. And if we add that to what's left, we come out with 13. So we have 13 words, 13 commands, even though Exodus 34 says 10 words. You know, it gets really odd. But again, as Sarna noted, in Jewish tradition, the actual number of imperatives, the actual number of commands, if you pressed them and said, well, what are the commands? How many commands? How many commandments did Israel get? They would say 13, you know, and then they'd wait for you to have the deer in the headlights look because they're Jewish and you're not. They know Hebrew and you don't. So they're right and you're wrong. You know, it's that kind of discussion. So this is how it's arrived at. It's 13 imperatives. But again, You could see, I'll just read them again. Here are the 3 in verses 3 through 6. you get, you shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image. You shall not bow to them or serve them. Okay. You know, so those are three different commands, but they all sort of point to the same thing. And you say, well, you know, we're not going to split them out. We're going to put them all together. Now we got 10. So there, again, this is how the debate goes. Back to the Bible Study Magazine for one more little paragraph here. Christian perceptions of Exodus 20 are not rooted in the Hebrew terminology, Aseret HaDevarim, 10 words. And so Christian formulations do not regard verse 1 as the first point of the Decalogue. And as a result, all of Exodus 20, verses 2 through 6, is considered the starting point. And the imperative wording, you shall not, prompted the commandment terminology so widely known and used today. And that's the end of the excerpt. And again, those three separate imperatives that all point to the same thing are considered essentially one. You know, so the numbering is actually an issue. Again, this was fought about between Jews and Christians. It became an issue between Protestants and Catholics. And so if you go to the episode webpage and you look at the chart there, you get a nice visualization of what the disagreements are and why they are what they are. Asarna lastly comments that Jewish, again, rabbinic tradition, you know, again, numbers the commands as more than 10. Again, you get 13, not 10. And this has become a sort of part of rabbinic tradition. But at any rate, 10 words, the actual biblical terminology from Exodus 34:28, seems to settle the number dispute. At least I'm thinking, this is me now. I'm thinking, well, you know, look, it calls it 10 words. So what, you know, what are you doing fiddling around with this 13 thing? Just, you know, forget that. But I would say Exodus 34:28 should settle that. So it seems best to try and articulate whatever these 10 words were as 10, as a unit of 10. That's just me, and you can look at the chart on the episode webpage. Fourth consideration for today's episode: what kind of law are the 10 commandments? These 10 words. Okay, what kind of law? And you say, well, what do you mean? They're just laws. Well, there are two types of law in the Hebrew Bible. And basically, everybody knows this and everybody agrees on it. And these are going to be distinctions that we, you know, sort of in our legal systems, you know, in the modern world are familiar with. So two types of laws in the Hebrew Bible. One is casuistic law. That's C-A-S-U-I-S-T-I-C, casuistic law. These are if-then laws. So if X does this, or X happens to be the case, then Y will happen, or Y is the outcome. So X, if then, X, then Y. This is very common in ancient Near Eastern legal codes. You see this all the time. The other kind of law is apodictic law. These are absolute prohibitions, thou shalt nots. Now, these don't lay out any conditions like the first kind does. There's no conditions here. These are absolute prohibitions. They are categorical, and they usually involve issues of religion and worship or morality. Now, Dictionary of Old Testament Pentateuch points out that, here's the quote, even if death is not prescribed, death is the understood penalty for breaking apodictic laws. Some scholars initially argued that the apodictic laws were uniquely Israelite, with the Sitz im Leben, that's a German phrase for the life setting, being Israelite religion. Thus, these laws reflected Israel's attempt to live completely under the guidance of their God. This argument is no longer credible because apodictic laws have been found in other ancient Near Eastern materials as well. Instead, apodictic law seems to operate in settings that rely upon persuasion for urging compliance with the law rather than upon physical force or structures, unquote. Now, I think this language and this assessment that I just read needs some rewording and, frankly, some rethinking in light of Exodus 19, verses 5 through 6, which we naturally covered earlier in an earlier episode. Just to remind you, Exodus 19, verses 5 and 6 says, now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine. You shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the people of Israel. That was God to Moses. So I would say it doesn't matter that other ancient Near Eastern cultures had apodictic laws. So what? The reasons for the apodictic laws are the issue. it's certainly true that Israel's identity was supposed to be distinct from the other nations. Again, that, and I think that is something we should not lose in our discussion here. Dictionary of Old Testament Pentateuch, that same entry goes on later to say this. The context for the giving of the Decalogue is a religious one, as God provides a covenant and in some sense a founding charter for the people delivered out of Egypt. Penalties need to be stated and enforced when laws are broken, if those laws are to be functionally effective. The stipulations of the Decalogue lack any prescribed punishment for those who break these laws, relying on fear of the Lord to promote allegiance to the terms of the covenant. Here, let me stop there. I would say, yeah, there's certainly the element of the fear of the Lord, but there's also the element of being holy and being a kingdom of priests. Back to the quote. Finally, the Decalogue addresses subject matter that is not culture-specific, but that instead has universal relevance and appeals to principles broadly held. For these reasons, the stipulations that form the Decalogue may be legitimately understood as ordinances or principles rather than laws in the strictest sense, you know, going by these definitions. So, okay, that to me that's quibbling a little bit, but again, I think there's content in there that's worth, again, you know, hearing and then, you know, making part of our own thoughts in relationship to what we're going to think about as we go through the laws in succeeding episodes. Fifth issue, the content and structure of the Decalogue. Now, it has long been realized that the content and structural elements of the Decalogue, again, both in terms of where it's positioned and, you know, its own order and all that kind of stuff, it's long been realized that the content and structure of the Decalogue bear some relationship to Hittite suzerain vassal treaties. The word suzerain is S-U-Z-E-R-A-I-N. So that this has long been known in biblical studies. This is because the Decalogue's context is clearly a covenant relationship. So we would expect it to look like covenants that people are going to know from other cultures and other parts of life, okay? Hence, scholars studying the structure of ancient Near Eastern covenants with the Sinai covenant have extended that inquiry to the content of the Decalogue and its placement in the wider book of Deuteronomy as well. Okay, recall that the Decalogue is repeated in Deuteronomy. Now, usually when you run into studies about the Decalogue and its relationship to Hittite, suzerain, vassal treaties, it's going to be like in a commentary on the book of Deuteronomy, not necessarily Exodus. So since the Decalogue is repeated essentially in both places, I wanted to bring this issue up, even though it's more pertinent to what we see in Deuteronomy in terms of a covenantal structure. But you still have a covenantal context here in Exodus 20, very obviously. Now, in Dictionary of the Old Testament Pentateuch, I'm going to read from a couple of the different essays here. The Covenants essay in that volume says this, suzerain vassal types of covenants there are between a major power and a lesser nation. Parity treaties sought to establish non-aggression between the parties and to guarantee the stability of the respective ruling dynasties. Suzerain vassal treaties served to consolidate the hegemony of the suzerain, the greater power. The vassal's interest, the lesser power, were clearly subordinate. Okay, end of quote. Now, the Form Criticism essay in Dictionary of the Old Testament Pentateuch says this. It adds this content. G.E. Mendenhall, who is a very famous scholar, deceased, maintained that the Book of Deuteronomy in its organizational structure and form is very similar to certain suzerain vassal treaties common in the ancient Near East. In its arrangement, Deuteronomy may thus be viewed as reflecting the same core sections, appearing in roughly the same order, as are found in ancient Hittite suzerain vassal treaties. These sections are as follows. There's a preamble. There's a historical prologue. It relates some historical circumstance. There are general stipulations given in the covenant. Then there are more specific stipulations given in the covenant. There are blessings and curses. There are witnesses brought, you know, to bear witness to what's going on here. And again, the witnesses sort of sign off. So those are the elements of a Hittite suzerain vassal treaty. And if you look at the way the Decalogue is presented in Deuteronomy, it really pretty closely, fairly closely follows those elements. Now back to the Dictionary of the Old Testament Pentateuch quote. When viewed in this light, the structure of Deuteronomy is a mirror reflection of a treaty form borrowed from a neighboring Near Eastern culture. This understanding of Deuteronomy, however, has not met with universal acceptance among scholars. Now, elsewhere, he's going to say this, the same entry. It should be noted here that the general stipulations, again, that's the part of Deuteronomy where the Decalogue falls, and then the specific stipulations come later. There are scholars, again, and I'm going to quote Eugene Carpenter here. Again, we're out of Dictionary Old Testament Pentateuch now, and Carpenter, I want to throw in, he adds this. There are scholars who have attempted to show that the literary structure and the content of sections of Deuteronomy form an exposition of each of these 10 words in order as they are repeated in Deuteronomy 5, 7 through 21. That's the end of the Carpenter quote. Now, I threw that in for this reason. He cites John Walton and Andrew Hill, their survey of the Old Testament, because they mention this. But another one of his sources is from Stephen Kaufman, The Structure of the Deuteronomic Law. It's in an Israeli journal, Marav, it's called. And it's a very lengthy article. It's 50 pages. Now, I bring it up for this reason. I think it's kind of important that we recognize that what is happening in Deuteronomy and also what's happening in Exodus, once you get out of the Decalogue, is that the content that follows, the legal stuff, the law stuff, the commandment stuff, is in fact deliberate. It's intentional that there is an attempt to apply the principles, you know, of the Decalogue to life situations. And so it's sort of an exposition of the Decalogue in both of these books, both of these cases. And that's important for realizing that, well, maybe that's why, part of the reason anyway, we have the Decalogues positioned where they are. They naturally have to precede what's going to follow in terms of an explication or actual situations that Israel is going to find itself in, you know, the people. And they're going to have to be, you know, thinking about what to do in light of the ethical principles laid out in the Decalogue. So, again, this is very, I think, understandable when you realize what's going on after the commands are given, that they're just being unpacked again in certain situations, you know, life circumstances, life situations, in both Exodus and Deuteronomy. Now, Sarna, however, I mean, I think it's fair to say probably that the majority of scholars accept some relationship of the Decalogue to the Hittite suzerain treaty idea. Now, Sarna is an example who hesitates, though, to embrace the model. And I wanted to include him because his reasoning is kind of interesting. Now, you think of what the Hittite suzerain vassal treaty was. It was a treaty. It was a covenant between an absolute authority and a lesser entity, okay, where the interests of the lesser entity aren't so much in view. It's the establishment of hegemony by the superior power in that kind of ancient Near Eastern treaty, the Hittite variety. That's kind of what Sarna objects to, the sort of the characterization. What a comparison to the Hittite suzerain vassal model sort of suggests or entails. And he writes this: a study of these documents, particularly a suzerain vassal treaty where one party transparently imposes its will on the other, leaves no doubt as to the influence of the ancient Near Eastern treaty patterns on the external, formal, literary aspects of the biblical berit, the biblical covenant. The affinities are to be expected. In order for the berit, the covenant, to be intelligible to the Israelites, it made sense to structure it according to the accepted patterns of the then universally recognized legal instruments. So he's okay with that part. Okay, you know, it reflects the structure. But again, he doesn't like sort of the implications. He writes this. Sarna says, the Decalogue and its contents are, however, in a class by themselves. The idea of a covenantal relationship between God and an entire people is unparalleled. Similarly unique is the setting of the covenant in a narrative context. It is the latter that imparts to the covenant its meaning and its significance. The covenant would be devalued were the link between them to be severed. Another major and original feature is the manner in which the content of the Berit, the covenant, embraces the internal life of the vassal by regulating individual behavior and human relationships. Such a preoccupation with social affairs is beyond the scope and intent of all other ancient treaties, whose sole concern is with the external affairs of the vassal, unquote. You know, I actually think that's well said. He's saying, look, you can't, even though the covenant could be modeled by the Hittite suzerain, you know, model or Hittite suzerain vassal treaty, he's saying, okay, structurally we can see that, but we can't lose sight of the fact of what makes this one, the Israelite one, unique. It's part of a narrative, which the others are never part of the narrative, and it's linked to more than an overlording relationship with Yahweh. There's a love relationship here going on in the Israelite circumstances, and that is something you don't find in the suzerain vassal treaty. So I wanted to include, you know, Sarna again because of his objection. I think there's substance to it. So lastly, our last consideration here for this episode is number 6. Why two tablets? Okay, why two tablets? Because you get that in the story. Now, Sarna writes this. Several biblical texts testify to the inscribing of the Decalogue on two stone tablets. The practice of recording covenants on tablets was well-rooted in the biblical world, as was also the custom mentioned in Exodus 25:16. I'll read that. And you shall put into the ark the testimony that I shall give you. Okay. So the practice of recording covenants on tablets, that's common, as was also the custom of depositing the document in a sanctuary. A treaty between the Hittite king Shupi-Lu-Liumas and King Matiwaza of Mitanni in Upper Mesopotamia noted that each of the contracting parties deposited a copy in his respective temple before the shrine of the deity. Similarly, when Ramses II of Egypt and the Hittite king Hattusilus concluded a treaty around the year 1269 BC, the clauses were inscribed on a tablet of silver, which was placed, quote, at the feet of the god. Okay. Why two tablets were needed for the Decalogue, Sarna says, is unclear, nor do we know the spatial distribution of the text. The Mechilta, again, that's rabbinic material, assumes that 5 declarations were incised on each tablet, which is the tradition reflected in Jewish art since the 13th century Spanish illuminated Bible manuscripts. However, such an arrangement would have resulted in a grave imbalance in Hebrew. One tablet would have contained 146 Hebrew words and the other only 26. The Palestinian Talmud has preserved a different tradition. They're given as the majority view that each tablet contained the entire Decalogue. That's the end of the Sarna quote. Now, the notion that both tablets held the complete Decalogue, in other words, you don't have two tablets, there's like 5 on one, 5 on the other, you know, that kind of thing. We're talking about here that both tablets had the entire set of laws on them, entire set of commands. That idea may be derived, it might derive from Exodus 32:15, which says this. When Moses turned and went down from the mountain with the two tablets of the testimony in his hand, tablets that were written on both sides, on the front and on the back, they were written, which is kind of interesting. You know, we kind of miss that detail that they're written on two sides. Now, Currid, again, he's the Egyptologist, trained Egyptologist, Old Testament scholar. We consulted a lot with the plagues. He writes, and he's quoting Meredith Klein here, who is a now deceased Old Testament scholar. I like Klein because he thinks out of the box, but he's quoting Klein here. Currid thinks that the answer lies in the ancient Near Eastern covenant practices. So here's what he says. It is now clear that the two tablets did not have different laws written upon each of them as was previously thought. As Klein comments, quote, the two tablets were duplicate copies of the covenant, and the correctness of this interpretation is decisively confirmed by the fact that it was normal procedure in establishing suzerainty covenants to prepare duplicate copies of the treaty text, unquote. And he's quoting from Klein's book, Treaty of the Great King, where Klein does a lot of this comparison with ancient Near Eastern covenantal structures. So what he's basically saying is, look, you have these examples with Ramses and the Hittite kings. They make two copies of the covenant, and then each of them deposits it with their deity at their respective homes, respective temples, whatever. Klein's saying, look, the two tablets did the same thing. They're two copies of the complete law, the complete Decalogue. Now, it's not made, the treaty is not made with another deity. So both of the copies get deposited in the Ark. That's why we have two. And on each, again, there's the full set. Now, I would say that's reasonable, though it's a little odd that the people would never see them. Okay, people. You know, both tablets are kept in the Ark. Okay, we know that to be the case. Nor is there any indication that they could be taken out and more copies made. So, note that there's nothing said about Moses or somebody else copying the text of the tablets before they were deposited, so as to eventually have them codified in Scripture. Now, this raises a problem. Well, if both of the copies are put in the Ark, well, nobody's taken them out. The high priest can't do that. I mean, he's only allowed in there once a year, and he can't touch the thing, So where do we get the laws? How do we know? Well, again, I think we can guess that, again, Moses or some other writer, whoever is actually the one, you could have a later writer taking, oral tradition that comes from the time of Moses and, putting it down into words and all that. This gets into the authorship issue, whatever. Somebody before they were were deposited within the Ark, I think would have made a copy of them. They would have written it out in some other form so that the people can know them and then they can be taught. And then the two tablets are stuck in there. There's no verse that contradicts that idea. There's no verse that says it, but there's no verse that contradicts that idea. We simply aren't told anything in that regard. So we have to suppose either that was done or the text was memorized. Maybe it was, oral. Maybe somebody memorized it. It's not that long. We have to presume something like that if we are going to presume an actual alignment of what was inscribed on the tablets with what we are reading today in our Bibles. We have to assume something like that happened. Now, those are the six issues I wanted to cover, to introduce the Ten Commandments, Exodus 20 more properly. And so next time on the podcast, we're going to dive into the individual commands. And there's a lot to think about. In a number of them. So I think it'll take at least two episodes to go through the Decalogue. But I think, again, all these things, are good setup. We will periodically, dip into this content while we're discussing, some of the other, the individual commands. But again, for right now, I think that was a good, introduction to the kinds of things that scholars think about when they approach something to us that's apparently a simple as Ten Commandments. Again, not quite that simple. There are issues here that need some consideration, and that will matter a little bit down the road.
All right, Mike, thank goodness for Jesus.
Well, there's a lot to think about with Jesus, too.
Yeah, that's true. Looking forward to it. All right, sounds good. Don't forget, Mike, we still have a few conference tickets available, so nakedbibleconference.com. Go get your tickets. And also, as we're moving along Exodus here, don't forget, we're going to be doing a specific Q&A podcast for Exodus. So if you have Exodus questions, send me those questions, TreyStrickland@gmail.com, and I'm collecting them all, and we'll go through your questions, because I know I've gotten several already, Mike, so people have questions out there. So don't forget, we're going to do that. And then also, Mike, go get your Exodus t-shirt. I want to see Mike.
I'll do that.
All right. You go do that, Mike. All right, Mike. Well, we will look forward to part two next week. And with that, I just want to thank you, everybody, for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.